This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. That is the sound of Sally Bowles, played by Liza Minnelli in the film Cabaret, screaming under a bridge. Do you ever feel like screaming? Do you do it silently into a cushion or out loud, and perhaps it surprised you, made you feel better? You weren't aware of your own volume, of your own power, of your own roar. Last month, a group of women in America decided to get all of their pandemic frustrations off their chests by shouting in a group in the middle of a football field. It's inspired other women around America to do the same. I'll be talking to a woman here in the UK who also took to screaming with her daughters during the pandemic. But what about you? Do you scream? If you don't, what do you do instead? How do you get it out? Whatever it is you need to get out. You can text me here at Woman's Hour on 84844. Of course, whatever you want to say, I suppose some of you may send us some of your screams on social media or on voice notes. We can hear those. On social media, it is at BBC Woman's Hour, or email us through our website. Of course, there'll be some of you thinking, well, I couldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. Don't dare do that because of the tropes around hysterical women and the way that we're viewed if we're slightly uncontrolled or unhinged. But I think hearing that scream this morning, it may inspire or it may revile you. You tell me, where are you about screaming? Let me know. Also on today's programme, the Health Secretary's so-called war on cancer and how it affects breast cancer. And meet Lazy Susan, the comedy duo dubbed two of the funniest women in the UK. All that to come. But first, as you've been hearing in the news, Downing Street has said the Prime Minister will not be apologising for claiming that the Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer, while Director of Public Prosecutions, failed to prosecute Jimmy Savile for sexual assault, a claim that is false. There have been renewed calls for Boris Johnson to retract the comments after Sir Keir was targeted yesterday by a gang of protesters near Parliament, some of whom could be heard shouting, "Paedophile protector." You may have seen the video. It's been widely shared from a few perspectives online. The Prime Minister has described those demonstrators' behaviour as disgraceful. It brings to the fore the issue of MPs and their safety once again. Well, who better, I'm sad to say, than to talk to than Kim Ledbetter, the sister, of course, of the murdered Labour MP Jo Cox, and now an MP herself representing her sister's former constituency of Batley and Spen, again for the Labour Party. Kim, good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
I'm sorry we have to talk about this in the terms of public safety and how it must make you and your family feel again, but I know that you feel strongly about this and you have tweeted about those scenes that you saw yesterday.
I have, yeah. I found yesterday really upsetting. It made me really angry. And we have to look at why it happened. And I think ultimately the individuals who were part of that angry mob have to take personal responsibility. But we also have to be clear that things don't happen in a vacuum. And while ever we have a culture of toxicity and aggression and lies in politics, we have to think about the consequences of that. And words and that culture filters down to other people. And it really concerns me that we've got a Prime Minister who seems to be stoking the anger that people feel in the country at the moment, and that can have real repercussions for society.
The Prime Minister, or rather his operation in Downing Street, which has of course been changing in the last few days, those who represent him, has doubled down. They've said he will not be apologising. What is your reaction to that?
I think that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. We've seen time and time and again recently situations that the Prime Minister could have made better. He could have calmed people's anger. And actually what he seems to do is just continually make things worse. And that is just not helpful. And ultimately, look, I don't want to come on this programme and try and score political points. That's not why I got involved in politics. Like lots of good people in Parliament, I got involved in politics to try and make a difference to people's lives. But there has to be a line around accountability of leadership. And if we have got a Prime Minister who is primarily trying to save his own skin, that is not good for our country, because everything else comes second. And that's how I feel about the current situation. You know, last Wednesday in PMQs, that was a really important statement about the Sue Gray report. And what the Prime Minister did was deflect from that. You know, he deflected, again, from the families who lost loved ones, from the people who made sacrifices, from the horrific situation we all found ourselves in during lockdown. He disrespected victims of sexual abuse, and he tried to score points. And we deserve better than that in this country. I spent some of yesterday speaking to a bunch of students and trying to encourage them to get involved in politics and engaged in public life. Why would they want to do that when we see this level of abuse, toxicity and a moral vacuum when it comes to the current leadership of the country?
I mean, that's how you would see it in light of these comments. I mean, perhaps you feel like that anyway. There'll be also others, even though you say you're not coming on here to score political points, saying, well, you are a Labour MP. Others may see it differently. And it has been, I should say, that particular comment has been rounded on by many Conservative MPs, both, you know, former ministers and actually some who are still close to the Prime Minister. And we also saw someone very senior, Muneera Mirza, one of his most senior advisers, resign over that particular comment. And I suppose, do you have any hope that he may retract it? And do you think that would do any good at this point?
Just to go back to what you've said, Emma, yes, I am coming on today as a Labour MP. But I wasn't a Labour MP at the time when Joe was murdered, and I wasn't a Labour MP for the last few years. Mm. And I have tried to call out inappropriate behaviour in public life for the last few years, wherever it has come from. This isn't about one side or the other. We've seen senior Conservative politicians be abused in the street. And, you know, I've spoken to lots of MPs since I've been in Parliament about the death threats that they face, the abuse that they face. This is across the political spectrum. And it's men, it's women, sadly, it's often people from ethnic minority backgrounds. This is a culture that needs to change, but it has to start with leadership and it has to start from the top. And that's where the Prime Minister has to take responsibility. And if he's said something that has been proved to be untrue, he should apologise for that and he should retract that. You know, I'm really, really clear on that. But that broader piece around what our politics looks like and actually what our society looks like is really important. Do we want to live in a country where we've got baying mobs harassing people in the street? You know, I always think about this on a human level. Keir and David's family and friends had to watch those scenes yesterday.
You're talking, just if I may, about Sir David Amos's family, of course, and the Conservative MP who was killed at the end of last year in October.
Well, yesterday I'm actually talking about David Lammy and Keir Starmer's family.
Forgive me.
Who had
David
to watch
Lammy
them being abused in the street. But you're absolutely right. My family had to watch it. David Amos's family had to watch it. And their pain will still be very raw. Mm. You know, so there is a bigger piece going on here. And you know, I've always said, of course we should have robust, passionate political debate in this country. It's the cornerstone of our democracy. But when that descends into abuse, insults, lies, and people screaming at each other in the street, I really hope we can agree that a line has been crossed and someone needs to reset the compass on what politics looks like.
What is something like yesterday like for you and your family?
It's awful. I mean, I'd got a really busy day planned today. I was meant to be doing a podcast this morning on loneliness. I was going to do some preparation work last night in my flat. And it just totally throws you. It totally throws you again because it brings back memories of what happened to us as a family. It makes me question why I'm doing this job. You know, on a really personal human level, it's really challenging. Mm-hmm. And I know that'll be same for lots of other MPs. And also, do you know what? More important than any of that personal stuff is the fact that I just want to get on and do my job. Yeah. It's Children's Mental Health Week. I've got a speech to write to talk about mental health and how important that is. I've got other stuff to do around. You know, we need to be talking about Afghanistan and Ukraine. We need to be talking about these other subjects. And you're suddenly distracted from all that. And, you know, we do have a way to reset the compass, but it has to come from the top so we can all get on and do our jobs.
Do you ring your mum on a day like yesterday? Do you have that chat? Does she worry about you doing this job?
I do. I texted my mum last night and I always said, do you think I should speak about it? And we have that conversation because, again, the other thing is as soon as you speak about it, you're putting yourself out there. Yes. So I then get the pylons on social media, what about this and what about that? And, you know, so you put yourself out there. And I've spoken to female MPs who've quite openly said to me, look, I don't talk about the abuse I get because I don't want to be a victim and I don't want to make it worse and I don't want to bring attention to my family. And I understand that. But I also think if people don't speak out, nothing will change. Mm-hmm. And my mum did say to me, you should say something. It's not right.
How do you find being an MP?
It's a different world. It's a really different world. But do you know what? There's some really good people in politics, Emma, and there's a lot of people who have come into this world to try and make a difference to people's lives, which is exactly what I've done. And that's why what's happening at the moment makes me really angry and really upset, because it's not doing our politics justice and it's not doing our country justice. I did an interview a few weeks ago with an Italian newspaper, a German newspaper and a French newspaper. Fortunately, I could do it all in English, so it wasn't too bad. But they were like, what is going on in the UK? This is embarrassing. The world is thinking, you know, you've lost the plot. And I find that really, really sad, because we should be so proud of our democracy and we should be so proud of our country. And like I say, most people in politics feel that, and most people in politics want to make a difference to their communities and to our country, the country that we love. And that's why this is so sad, that it detracts from that. So, you know, I want to focus on the things I can do to make a difference to people in Batley and Spen. And hopefully, you know, if I can be a little part of trying to make politics a better place to be, a more positive place to be, then that'll be good enough for me. But everybody, including the Prime Minister, has to be part of that journey.
You know, I'm just struck, there's a poll out today, and I haven't got an equivalent one for men, but Mumsnet did a research of their users, which said more than 9 in 10 women said they would never stand for election, while nearly half stated they'd rather give birth again without drugs than get involved in politics. I just wonder, you know, what you make of that, because you are, as you say, this was not thrust upon you, but I know you thought long and hard about whether to stand and whether to go into politics. You didn't come into it almost by choice, if I could put it like that.
No, you're totally right. At some point I did make a choice, but it wasn't a path that I would ever chosen other than through what had happened to us. Now, I've never given birth, but I have to be honest, at the moment it's looking quite appealing compared to everything that's going on right now. But on a serious note, you know, again, we need good, strong women in politics. And you're quite right. Why would you look at everything that's going on now and think you want to put yourself forward to be part of that? And I really hope women do. I really hope young women do. I really hope people from ethnic minority backgrounds do, because we need representation in politics. We need our parliament to look like our society and like our communities. And, you know, I really hope people aren't discouraged, but it is not easy. But then we don't make it easy for ourselves sometimes, do we? And that's what I feel is going on at the moment. I think, you know, politicians have got a responsibility to behave responsibly. And at the minute, we're not seeing that from certain quarters.
Kim, final question. Have you spoken to Boris Johnson? Would you be able to get his ear on this, as, of course, you know, the family member, the sister of an MP who lost their life, who was murdered?
Look, I don't think Boris Johnson's interested in listening to me. He didn't welcome me to Parliament when I got the job. I've had very little to do with him. He did eventually write a note to me. But I don't think Boris Johnson wants to listen to people like me. I think he wants to save his skin. And I think he wants to make sure he, you know, yeah, he's still Prime Minister. And at the moment, it feels like that's pretty much all he cares about. And I find that really sad.
Kim Leadbetter, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. She's the Labour MP for Batley and Spen, the seat that her sister, the murdered Labour MP Jo Cox, formerly held, talking in response to the fact that Downing Street has doubled down, saying that the Prime Minister will not be apologising for falsely claiming that the Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer, while Director of Public Prosecutions, failed to prosecute Jimmy Savile for sexual assault. That was after protests yesterday surrounding Sir Keir Starmer and also David Lammy, as Kim Ledbetter mentioned. And they surrounded him and were heard to be saying, some of those protesters, that he was a paedophile protector. A message just coming in here saying, Anya has messaged in to say, Kim is the right type of MP and indeed a leader that we need, honest and full of empathy at a hugely difficult time. Well, talking of difficult times, I cannot tell you how many messages have been coming in response to my question about screaming. Have you ever felt like you wanted to scream from the top of your lungs? Dee says, I've been screaming for decades, ever since a therapist suggested it when I had a severe bout of depression in my early 30s. My favourite places to scream are in the car, or on the beach at a stormy sea and into a strong wind. Brilliant. There's an anonymous message here, and I'll remind you why I've asked you this, which is just brilliant, saying, I take a baking tray outside and I smash it repeatedly against the brick wall side of my house. It's extremely satisfying, and I've wrecked two baking trays up to now. Picture that. If you do like screaming or, I don't know, smashing up baking trays, you'll be in good company. Last month, a group of mothers from Massachusetts in America decided to get all of their pandemic frustrations off their chest, literally by shouting in a group in the middle of a football field, and it's inspired other women around America to do the same. What about this craze then coming to the UK on a more mass level? Behaviour and data scientist Professor Pragya Agarwal decided to start screaming with her daughters during lockdown, and the psychology lecturer Dr. Rebecca Semmons-Wheeler is also on hand to give her take on this. Pragya, I'll start with you. Good morning.
Morning, Emma.
Why do you scream?
I think a few reasons. Obviously, it's good for health. We know from research that it releases endorphins and it can make us feel stronger. Like tennis players, when they grunt and scream, they actually have more strength in their shots. But when I started doing this, I was researching and writing for my next book, which is called Hysterical. And I was increasingly getting angry about the historic and the scientific research that showed these expectations that are placed on women, that we have to be nice and we have to be sweet. And we are not told to how to channel this anger and fury and rage. And these are considered negative emotions. And I didn't want my children, I have twin girls, they were three at the time when we started with the pandemic. I didn't want them to grow up with these kind of gendered expectations and stereotypes that they can't scream, that they have to suppress all the emotions. I wanted to show them that all emotions are healthy and that we can actually release them in a way that feels good for us.
But where do you do it? Do you go somewhere? Are you in the house? Is anyone nearby?
During the lockdown, we were just doing it inside the house, or we would sit in the car sometimes and scream quite loud, or we would run around the garden and scream. Sometimes we would run up and down the stairs, and they would usually take their old clothes off and scream while I just ran around with them. And then we would flop on the floor laughing, and it really helped us bond as well. But sometimes we would stand in warrior pose in the middle of the room and raise our arms up to the ceiling or as if to the sky, and showing that we are releasing all the stress from our bodies and we're going to scream as loud as we can.
Nice. A bit of naked screaming and warrior pose screaming. Yes. Do you live with anyone else? Do you have a partner?
Yes, my husband. I think he used to go and hide sometimes.
he wasn't joining in?
My dog and my cat were really scared and terrified. But they have to get used to it, you know, women screaming.
Pragya, let me bring in Rebecca at this point. It is undoubtedly a release. What do you make of it, though, as a strategy for releasing and as a way of coping?
I have to say that Pragya's description of screaming just sounds really fun.
It does.
I'm quite tempted to try it myself. And yeah, maybe I'll be a convert. But yeah, I mean, as you said, Pragya, it does help to release emotions. You know, Yanov came up with this primal therapy in the 70s. It was primarily designed to help people who'd suffered or experienced childhood trauma. So I think, you know, as you said, you know, women, definitely this perception of screaming. I love the title of your book, by the way, Hysterical, because we're tarnished by that, really, you know, about not being able to express emotion. I think that's really, really important. However, if we are using it just to release repressed emotions, that we kind of do lack a bit of, and I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, lack a bit of subtlety and nuance. So I would kind of maybe liken that to, you know, blowing open our emotions with dynamite. So there's the kind of need to pick through that and unpack and explore what those underlying issues are. So what's causing the frustration or the depression? You know, what, you know, that there might be a whole range of sort of structural issues or personal individual issues that lead us to feel like we don't feel strong, that we do need to have that endorphin release. And obviously it's not the only way of releasing endorphins. So there's quite a few things, you know, there's a few different levels. There's obviously the social level of bonding and also with those gendered expectations. Then there's the biological level, which you've already touched on as well, you know, endorphins and the bonding, you know, a sense of common humanity. So Kirsten Neff, she's this great researcher on self-compassion, talks about the three levels of, you know, kindness, care and understanding to ourselves, sense of common humanity. And I think when women get together or people get together and scream, we have this sense that we're not alone, we're not doing it by ourselves. But then the third component of self-compassion is mindfulness. So it's bringing that awareness to, you know, what's happening in the body. And, you know, warrior pose. So I'm a yoga teacher as well. So yeah, really, you know, warrior pose helping us to unify the mind and body. So balancing those things.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what you're saying there is perhaps you need to be looking at why you're needing to scream and what is the best way to help yourself. And for some, it may be a mixture of those things. For some, it may be better to do others. But I wonder, why is it that women want to perhaps get together and scream? Not all women, but some women are finding this appealing. And you know, of course, others will be thinking this is completely not for me. And also, I don't want to look like the hysterical woman. But do men want to scream as well, Rebecca?
I haven't really seen much research on this, but I think that men, I mean, I'm just going to go with a stereotype. I know that all football fans aren't men, but men have these kind of rituals of going to things like football matches. And I'm really aware that not all men do this, but it does tend to be that men have these kind of, you know, my partner goes to like the boys' curry club. I don't think they scream in the restaurants, but, you know, they go and they have the, you know, delicious food together and they have this bonding. And I think women do, I think, you know, there are circumstances, but my colleague, Dr. Keely Abbott, she's a gender expert, and she was talking about how women don't have as many of these opportunities to do these bonding rituals together, these rituals where there are sort of more communities. And I think that's especially been difficult during lockdown. And again, not to kind of overgeneralize here, but I think women, you know, and I'm not a parent, but my through some of the work I do and just knowing women who've been parents, that has been particularly isolating, particularly for many women during the pandemic. So I'm not surprised that there's a kind of need for reclamation of this bonding experience, that sense of getting together and common humanity. And women do tend to get together to connect around emotional expression, I think, more than men in general. I would say that is a kind of a gendered trait. And again, not to kind of generalize, but that would be a trend among women more so.
Pragya,
I don't know of any research on that.
No, well, it would be fascinating. Pragya, I think you'll find some of these messages amazing, as I am as well. Just so honest and so brilliant. Instead of screaming, I've got a message here that says, I fling bottles and jars as hard as possible into the bottle bank. Smash, works for me. Another one, I scream when I'm driving. If anyone hears, I just don't care. There's quite a lot of people doing this on their own, Pragya, not needing to be with others, although that's also part of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think the release of emotions and be able to have a safe space, a non-judgmental space where you can just let go of all the rage. We talk about not being able to talk about the motherhood rage and all the anxiety and all the stress that you're carrying. And again, we're coming back on the gendered stereotypes again and again about how men can, from a very young age, boys are socialized to be wild and to scream and to be loud, while girls are taught to be quiet and to be nice and to not raise their voices. And yes, things are changing, but I think still those expectations are placed on women quite a lot. And so just to have a safe space where you don't feel judged for raising your voice, for showing your frustration, for not being labeled hysterical,
I like that, if I may, I like that the car's coming up again and again. Yeah. But I do think in your own home, you know, if your home is a safe space, if you're happy with who you're living with, but you still need to vent, I think there is. And if you are living with a man, there can be that judgment still, you know, even if it is your home, because of the idea of the crazy lady. I mean, I just watched Wuthering Heights at the National Theatre in London last night, and there was a lot of screaming in that. And, you know, even watching that, you think, I wonder how some of the men will be interpreting this well-known, you know, this interpretation of a well-known story, and the women in it. Will they be able to access the pain, or are they going to be distracted by the idea that, you know, these women are hysterical and not to be trusted as full characters?
Yeah, we see that these stereotypes play out in art and literature all the time. The women's nerves are really frail or fragile. And as we keep coming back to the whole trope of type of hysterical. Yes, I mean, I think there is judgment, especially as I was going through perimenopause, I realized that I was getting really angry, and I was constantly hearing, you're being very angry these days. And I think it's just that suddenly, not meaning to impose these stereotypes, people do that. People do impose these expectations that you have to stay calm. And I'm not saying that screaming is a solution to everything, to all the emotional stress or anxiety or trauma that you might be carrying, and there are structural and systemic issues as well. But I think to be able to reclaim that narrative is really, really important, to be able to express our anger, not just as sadness, because we know from research that women often express it as sadness because it's a low status emotion, and they're not able to express it as anger because it's a high status emotion, and that's accorded to men in our society. So to be able to reclaim that narrative, I think is really, really important, besides the biological and emotional aspects.
You're speaking to the converted. I'm presently in a huge amount of pain with endometriosis, and I want to scream. We're not going to do it right now. I think we have to do it when it feels like we're in the moment, Pragya. Maybe we'll do it another time. And maybe I'll burst the volume levels here at the microphone. But I think, you know, being in pain, a life in pain, you just want to scream in frustration or something, don't you? Just let it out. Let it all out. Thank you so much for being so generous with your honesty. I expect nothing less. The book that you were talking about, Hysterical, Exploding the Myth of Gendered Emotions by Professor Pragya Agarwal and Dr. Rebecca Semmons-Wheeler. Thank you so much for your insight. And actually, I love this from Mary, who says, shouting at the radio makes me feel better. I hope you're shouting at me occasionally. I'd take that as a compliment. Or not. Gillian says, I realised years ago while having singing lessons that reaching for some top notes is really a controlled scream. Now I'm 75, I still do it every week at choir practice. Some of you are getting in touch very much to say singing is another way of getting that same feeling. Kathy says, in my childhood, we had a coal fire. I used to get rid of my frustrations by going out to fill the coal bucket. As an adult with central heating, I changed the duvet cover. Both tasks are exhausting. No anger left afterwards. That's a good change you're doing of that duvet cover. Sophie says, during lockdown and even over this winter, I would go and scream in the fields behind our house along with a vixen, assuming a fox here, who lives in the quarry. It's been a visceral and powerful release. We need to howl and scream. It's primal and euphoric. Hannah is one of those living with a screamer. My former housemate used to scream a lot while we were all working at home during lockdown. The sound made me really tense and more stressed. I find that a few deep, slow, calming breaths is much more effective for releasing tension and relaxing your body. Well, listening to somebody else scream, I can totally understand, may stress you out and have the opposite effect. But I've just got this brilliant vision of so many of you screaming in cars, banging baking trays, going out, banging your duvet cover. How you let it out, let me know. Do keep those messages coming in. And Mark, just final one for this part, but I will come back to the messages if I can, says, I've actually screamed under that very bridge from the Cabaret film, that clip we played out right at the start of the programme, back in the early 90s with a Berlin friend. It was a great experience, and I for one find a good scream or roar, usually discreetly done, I don't know how you do that, really helpful to my mental health when things get too much, a discreet roar. And Belinda's swearing by boxing during her divorce, but screaming, she says, sounds fun. Well, I did mention health and how you get through things. Let's look at the state of part of our health, or what's not going on at the moment that perhaps should. New analysis commissioned by the Labour Party says that almost 300,000 people in England were unable to see a cancer specialist within 2 weeks of an urgent referral between April and November last year. The research, which used information from the House of Commons Library, found that more than 90,000 of those breaches for those who may have breast cancer. It's the highest number of breaches in the 11 years since the target was introduced. And as the Prime Minister promises new targets to tackle the NHS backlog, let's talk now to Baroness Delith Morgan, Chief Executive of Breast Cancer Now. More than 90,000 waiting for referrals. What do those waiting times mean for the women involved?
Well, I think we have to remember that each one of those in that 90-odd thousand, that's an individual, that's a woman really worrying, potentially very anxious, potentially with a breast lump, potentially with nipple discharge or skin puckering, symptoms that they're really worried about. And we know that the most important thing to tackle cancer in this country has got to be about early diagnosis. And during the pandemic, you know, the screening programme was paused in many parts of the country, and we saw a really significant drop in the number of women diagnosed with breast cancer. So that means that the chance for them to get the best possible treatment and have the best possible outcomes is limited. So I feel very concerned about this. And, you know, I just want to really encourage everyone who's worried about that they might have breast cancer to come forward and seek help.
Because, just with a referral, do you know something is wrong or you don't know anything at all at that point?
No, well, there are so many different aspects to going to see the doctor with a worry about breast cancer. It might be that you have found a lump or you've got breast pain. Breast pain is very rarely turns out to be cancer. But what it means is that you've identified that there's something wrong and you need to have it checked out, and your GP would normally refer you on. And depending on their assessment of your concerns, they may refer you urgently to be seen within 2 weeks. And that is something that is really important part of the breast cancer strategy in this country, to get women seen as quickly as possible. And of course, we have a screening programme, which again is a really essential part of tackling breast cancer, which is the most common cancer in women. So, we want to ensure that where women are called for screening, that they take up that appointment, because at the moment they're just being sent out open invitations, say, do ring us and set up an appointment. People are busy. You know, they may not get around to setting up that appointment, and it's really valuable.
I'm just looking at the statement from the Department of Health and Social Care about this, talking about cancer diagnosis and treatment remains a top priority. The pandemic's put enormous pressure on the NHS, causing waiting lists to grow, but most cancer services are back or above pre-pandemic levels. What do you make of that?
Well, firstly, I don't think it's good enough to be at the pre-pandemic level because, you know, we've been failing to meet breast cancer targets for years. So we need to have a really significant investment in the cancer workforce. And we've been calling for this for years. And so that's why this initiative that Sajid Javid kicked off at a round table on Friday, mm-hmm. I think is really valuable. We need to have that long-term commitment to the workforce to make sure that these backlogs, and we are talking about backlog, even if the NHS is actually seeing, you know, more people, there's still, we estimate about 9,000 breast cancer diagnoses that have yet to be made up. So, you know, there are real worries about how the system can cope. You know, I would say, and I do want to say this, that we are so, you know, we absolutely have to thank all the healthcare professionals working in the NHS under massive pressure. There just aren't enough of them.
Please, I apologise, but it was just also the other part of this statement, and people may remember this, that Sajid Javid, the Health Secretary, Health and Social Care Secretary, has declared a national war on cancer. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's not a surprise to me that cancer and cancer targets and the backlog and the, you know, those waiting for diagnosis would become a focus in the current political debate. I suppose what I'm interested in is how can we make the most of the opportunity of having these big political beasts interested in trying to crack the problem.
And of course, but there are those who have lived through cancer, who are related to those who perhaps didn't, and they loathe the "this is my battle." They loathe the language of war, you know. And you're the chief executive of Breast Cancer Now. Is it helpful to have a health and social care secretary saying, "I've declared war on cancer"? You may say it's semantics. It's just it is something that's caught people's ear.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of people would never use the language of the battlefield to talk about the experience of cancer. You know, when people say so-and-so lost their battle with cancer, it breaks my heart because, you know, if you could fight your way out of it, who wouldn't? You know, it's not like that. So, yeah, I mean, a war on cancer is a phrase to grab attention. But what I'm interested in, you know, is what can we get into the system? Can we get a long-term plan with investment for the workforce? You know, where's the recovery plan that was meant to come out yesterday? You know, the government promised that we would have caught up all the backlog by May, by March 22. Now it's being said that's going to be March 23. There is real urgency to tackle this, and it's got to be through the workforce. There aren't any easy answers. Everyone's working flat out. You know, we've got a quarter of radiologists, vital part of the diagnostic workforce. A quarter of radiologists are retiring in the next 5 years. Well, where's the solution to that? It's got to be a long-term funded solution to the workforce. And if you're running an NHS hospital or a service, a screening service, if you don't know how you're going to pay for the workforce growth that is needed, how are you going to manage? We've got to have more certainty about how the workforce is going to be funded.
Well, indeed, reports about a row of between the Treasury and Number 10 at the Treasury and NHS England. This is perhaps what's been described as the reason for the delay to that plan that you mentioned that we don't yet have. Going from the macro to the kind of day-to-day, the individual level, if you are listening, if you're a woman listening, perhaps you are concerned about something specifically, we've been talking about breast cancer, about a lump or anything that seems a bit unusual. We can never say it too many times. What should you do?
Well, the most important thing is to be mindful of the fact that most breast lumps turn out not to be cancer. So please feel reassured that there's a good chance that everything's fine, but do seek help. Go and see your GP, or if you're invited for screening, I would say attend that screening appointment and get yourself checked out. Be breast aware, and remember that, you know, where breast cancer is diagnosed early, the outcome can be really positive. You know, it is a very, very, very good prognosis, but it's so important to get checked out and to seek help. And if you're worried about anything, if you've got if you've got breast cancer already, or if you've got incurable breast cancer and you need support, then do please get in touch with Breast Cancer Now. And we've got a helpline staffed by nurses, and, you know, there's all that support there for you.
Frank's email says, the husband of a breast cancer patient, I must emphasise it's also not just the timing of the initial referral that's crucial, but the waiting periods for every step in the process. Each period presents an agony of fear and slowly erodes the mental health for the whole family. Just giving an insight there from someone supporting someone going through this at the moment. We are talking about how you vent, how you release. Are you a screamer, Baroness Dalith Morgan?
Well, I'm a singer, actually, and I was listening to that that discussion that you just had. I thought it was brilliant because it does release that, you know, those endorphins. And, you know, last night I went to my choir practice for the first time in ages, and, you know, I've lost the strength in my voice through the pandemic because I just haven't been practicing. But it's just so amazing to be able to sing and enjoy that. And to share it, as you're saying, I go with my sister who has secondary breast cancer, and, you know, her breast cancer is incurable. And it's one of the things that we do together, and it's just amazing. So I would recommend shouting, singing, anything gets you out there.
All of the above. I love the smile that swept across your face as I asked, are you a screamer? But singer came out instead, which I have to say is a trend as well with lots of the messages we're getting this morning. Baroness Dalith Morgan, Chief Executive of Breast Cancer Now. Thank you. Janet says on email, I so agree. Women are always told to be calm and quiet. The biggest example is how we're told to give birth quietly with little breaths and control. Why? When in pain, it is normal to scream. So why has the whole of birthing been taken over by this idea? From her point of view, I didn't stay quiet. I screamed the whole way through both of my children's births when I needed to and wanted to. And Natasha in Eastbourne says, I've been screaming in my car at lunchtime when work was so stressful. I always thought they should build a screaming soundproof booth at work. You know, there's these rage rooms. Have any of you been to those? I don't quite know what you do in them, but they sound very appealing. I need to check them out. Apparently, that's more of a trend as well. Going into somewhere and being pretty angry and being able to smash the place up without having to tidy up. Key point, very key point indeed. Keep those messages coming in. Let's turn our attention now to the number of children in the care system, which is at an all-time high, according to the Department for Education. There are 80,000 children in care in England alone. But we're going to look now at the law around siblings and what's actually going on for those in care and being split from those that they have known as their family and sometimes are their only support. The law says that siblings in care should stay together if it's safe and appropriate to do so, but almost half of children in care are not living with at least one of their siblings. A new BBC documentary called Split Up in Care, Life Without Siblings explores this issue. It's on iPlayer now, and I can talk to Rachel Mussey-Kiwa, who's a ambassador for the charity Action for Children, and Keela Brinkley, who mentors young girls in the care system. And both Rachel and Keela were separated from their respective siblings in care. A warm welcome to you both. Rachel, I thought I'd start with you and understand your experience in care. What can you tell us a bit about that and how old you were when you were first separated from your siblings?
Hi. So I got separated from my siblings when I was about 11 or so. We'd actually moved into foster care together into our first foster home. But then after like 2 years or so, we actually got separated, which I'm not too sure on the fine line details of why we got separated, but I ended up moving to another foster carer and my siblings ended up moving somewhere else. But I believe they were going to be put up for adoption, but because I was older, older children aren't really like wanted to be adopted, but my siblings were much younger, so they were wanted to be adopted and stuff like that.
And what was that like being apart from them?
It was a horrifying experience, I can't lie. Especially going into foster care, you're with strangers, you're not used to the experience, you don't know what's going on. But then being with my siblings at first was fine because it was able to, like, I was able to tolerate it. Especially being a Black kid, I've grown up with my siblings, like, being like a mother to them, and it's part of our culture type thing. So it was quite strange not being able to have that bond with my siblings or be able to be there for them, make sure they're okay. So I just spent most of my foster care experience when I separated from them just worrying about them constantly and not being able to actually live my life because I was constantly worried about them.
Were you able to have contact or was it some time until you were able to be together again?
It actually took a lot to actually get that contact. I was fighting to see them for years and years until obviously Action for Children chipped in and started advocating on my behalf, going into my meetings. I had to like protest constantly to be able to see my siblings. It kept being like pictures and videos, but I was like, that's not enough, especially with family and the fact that I was by myself, my parents are together, my siblings are together. I wanted to physically see them and make sure they're physically okay, but it took years to actually get that in place.
And how's the relationship now?
Now we're just sort of working on it. It's a working experience. I actually talk to my siblings now. I actually see my sister and my brother more often. My other sister did get, unfortunately, put up for adoption. So I'm not going to see her until she probably turns 18 at some point. But I am building a good, strong relationship with my siblings currently.
Thank you so much for that. Let me bring in Keela at this point. Good morning.
Good morning.
How old were you when you and your sibling were separated?
So me and my sister were separated about the age of 10, 11 after being in care together. There's only 18 months between me and my sister. But when we separated, I went to a solo placement, specialised placement, and my sister went to a mixed parent placement. And that's what she'd requested. But it was hard. We had regular contact.
And so you were able to keep in contact?
Yeah, and I think that's the importance as well when siblings are split up, is about remaining in contact and giving children a full explanation and clear explanation as to why the split has happened. I think because that's, as children, you start to question yourself and your own behaviour.
I understand you actually at first would make sure you could see each other by running away to be together.
Yeah, that's what we used to do at one stage, because local authorities like to say, we'll hold contact off for a while, let them settle in their placement. It doesn't work, you know. So we used to run away and be with each other. And I think after a while it just got too much and they realised it's better for us to have the contact then to stop it.
Do you think it had, or what rather, I'm sure it did have, impact did it have not being with her, though, as much as you had been? So not living together?
It was that difficult. I think as children, obviously, it's difficult because you've now took away that one last thing that we held on to. You know, you took away our parents, now you've took away our siblings, and that's how it looks. As you grow older, I think your view changes that little bit because now that I'm older, I can see that we both had different needs.
And I was going to say, because some may, with experience of this on either side, may say sometimes splitting siblings can actually be better.
It can have a better outcome sometimes. And for me and my sister, I think at the time, obviously, it wasn't great. We both rebelled. We was both kicking off. You know, it caused a lot of issues. But now coming away from it, I can understand why we were split. We was breaking down placements together.
Right.
We was unfosterable together because we just break everything down and we didn't have our own identity. We both lived in each other's footsteps. When we were split, we was able to find our own identity. We was both able to get the support that we needed individually. And I think now it benefited us, and I feel like that's what's made our relationship now very positive. I think living together, we could have broke up a lot of the relationships that we've got now.
And just so I'm clear, when you say you broke up the placements, what would that mean?
Me and her would just break down placements. We wouldn't settle.
Right. And not be able to get on with whom you'd been put with and were trying to look after you.
Yeah, basically, because it was just, it was a bit of guilt. Both of us would be like, don't listen to her, don't do this, don't do that. And we'd stick in force with each other. You know, the foster carer couldn't tell off her without me stepping in. You know, there would be no punishments. They couldn't do it because one of us would kick off because the other one couldn't do something. And it just wouldn't work.
Rachel, to bring you back in on this, you know, and as an ambassador now for the charity Action for Children, I suppose there's a different insight there as well, isn't it, about how it can be better, even if you can't see it at the time. What do you make of that?
Oh, I fully understand that. I've seen a lot of different placements where I'm like, yeah, that probably did need that separation. From my personal experience, I feel like now I've started speaking to my sister more and we're more like communicating about how she felt during the time. I realised that maybe it wasn't the best thing for us personally because we really did need each other's support. We were really just like being siblings and it was completely out of our nature to be separated in our circumstances. But obviously I've not really fully read my paperwork and stuff like that. So there's probably things I don't know because when you've got a child's mind, you see everything under like a rose-coloured glasses. So, but I do understand the concept of like some children do need that separation to be able to grow separately and then meet back together at the end.
Well, had you asked me this many years ago, I would have been like, no, it was the worst thing they could have ever done. You know, how dare they separate us? But I think now that I'm older and I've got a child and I've looked back at my paperwork and I've read things and I thought, do you know what, actually that was the best thing that could have happened for us.
I love that that's you know, that's changed in you and that you can say that as well, you know, that you can get a different perspective.
Yeah, and I think working now with children in care as well has helped me open my eyes to see things differently.
But I suppose also, Rachel, from your point of view, that, you know, your siblings were your family, they were your constant, and I read in your conversations that you had with one of our producers that you know you said you'd also been like a parent to them.
Yeah, I'd grown up being like a mother figure to my siblings, which I can understand from that perspective. If I was separated, then I could grow separately to my siblings. But I just feel like for me, it put me in a bad depression. It put me in a bad anxiety. I felt really lonely. I just felt really isolated. Like it took a lot for me to be able to come out of that depression, like my foster care support and like social services support to actually get me out of that depression and actually carry on with my life was a lot, considering I could have just stayed with them and just blossomed and been like counselled in order to grow as a single sister rather than a mother figure.
Thank you so much. Final word, Keila.
I think that's what it takes. I think when you're separating siblings, things need to be put in place, like therapy and counselling.
Yeah.
And, you know, the relationship should be as if there's a extended family, not that they're split. Yeah. They should be, in foster care should be encouraged the young people to come over and have dinner. And, you know, it should just be like they're with an auntie and uncle and you can still meet on Christmas and stuff like that. And exactly. I think it needs to be done properly.
Keila, Rachel, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. Okay,
thank you.
And reflecting on those experiences. Many more messages still coming in light of that conversation, but also still so many about how you vent, how you get out that stress. I mean, therapy was just mentioned there, of course, in a very much a different setting and how to deal with something extremely serious. But I suppose some of you, when you're just dealing with the day to day, how you deal with that. I think this sounds a bit like it could be in the sketch of my next two guests. Jane's emailed to say, I seldom have the opportunity to scream as often as I'd like. I've been asking you if that's what you do to vent. But I've found that dropping an unwanted ceramic gift onto the patio is a good alternative. The only downside is the cleaning up. Well, what do my next guests, Freya Parker and Celeste Drin, make of that? They are known as the comedy duo Lazy Susan. And you may have seen their show, which is brand new on BBC Three, just been debuted. Good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
Good morning. I would love to smash some ornaments. I'm also fascinated by these rage rooms.
Me too.
What an incredible idea. I'm laughing, but also like, I am going to Google that.
Yeah, no, I've been meaning to. Annoyingly, I've probably been so frustrated or concerned about something, I've not had the time to actually look up the rage room. But you could take that for us. Maybe you can work that into something.
Love to.
Yeah. I've been watching. I've watched quite a bit of your work, and it's definitely raised many a wry smile as well as out loud laughter. But the phone line of abuse, just as also returning to our first conversation about being an MP at the beginning of the programme today, tell our listeners a bit about that and what was the inspiration for that.
Well, it was a sketch that got written very near to filming, so I think there were some. nerves or there was some fear starting to arise as we got closer to actually making the show. It's called Sketch Hotline and it's like an 80s infomercial.
Oof.
But it's really about...
The line, our line has just gone...
And tell us you hate them personally. And it's us just in a very...
Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do a bit of production here. Perhaps we might have to turn off your video to improve the connection, and then we can keep going. So the irony was, I was asking you about a phone line, and your line destroyed itself. Say that again. So it was like an 80s setting. Go for it.
Yeah, it looks like an 80s infomercial, but it's basically us breaking the fourth wall or whatever you call that in TV, and saying, "Look, if you hate us and you hate the show and you want to tell us that." Don't tweet us, don't get us on Instagram, ring this hotline and you can tell us personally. And then it's us just being very friendly and professional, answering all these horrible calls, basically.
Incredibly professional.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
How do you come up with the sketches, Freya or Celeste, whoever wants to take the lead? Because we haven't actually, I hadn't thought about this, but we haven't really seen that many sketch shows lately in the UK.
Yeah, I think... It's always all sorts. It can be sort of, you know, pure imagination. It can be me and Celeste just observing each other in quite a creepy way and then being like, I've got got an idea for a character. And I'm always like, oh, that sort of seems like me, but she's called Sarah. Okay. Or just, you know, you see.
Yeah, I always change the name. I'm very clever.
Yeah, yeah. She's sneaky like that. Or, you know, you walk down the street and as you all do, you hear someone walking past having a conversation. It's a funny turn of phrase. Or like the sketch hotline thing. It's just either seeing the abuse that people get online or some of it that we've had ourselves and thinking like, we want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But how do we do it in a way that's not a lecture?
Yeah. A lot of my stuff, it's just basically fear really packaged as a sketch. But I think it's hard to know where the ideas come from, but when you start having one, you just become aware, does this have legs or what is this skewering? What is this joke? And does it have enough in it to sustain a 2-minute skit? Because sometimes you hear something, you see something that's funny, but it doesn't always translate into a sketch. So it becomes about identifying what's got legs and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
How are you managing the, you know, trying not to fall into, you know, what some people would say are the tropes of what female comedians cover?
I don't know. The thing about even that sort of phrase female comedian, I think obviously
female comedian.
Comedian.
I didn't call you that. I was very deliberate.
You didn't. I think there's always that adage like write what you know. Mm. And obviously our lived experience where we're two women. So I think that is always going to be in the fabric of the work that you make. But I think rarely do people sit down and think what female comedy am I going to make today?
No, but we are hearing more and more comedians talk about the fact they're thinking about what they can say, what they can't say, what's their right to say. I suppose it feeds into that wider discussion. And I didn't know if any way, do you feel you can fully write freely?
Pretty much.
I think, yeah, I actually think we never really feel any limitations on what we can write. And I think it's more, I mean, going back to the sort of the female kind of female comedy or female lens, often that stuff is put on, say you're writing TV, it's after the work is done, and then people will either look at it when they're starting to package it to sell it or pitch it, and they'll say like, oh, it's a female driven show about female friendships and it's just women now, zeitgeist, and it's all these sort of words start being put upon your work. But I think it never actually, I don't think it ever sort of, I don't feel any limitations.
I think in terms of what you're asking about, what do we think about when we're writing? Are we worried about what can we say, what can't we say? I think the only worry we have is it funny or not? And I think, you know, I don't know whether you're touching on cancel culture or if this is about being women, because I think with the women stuff, you just have to do what's funny and accept that you're going to get a certain amount of abuse for being a woman in comedy. That is part of the territory and it's not good, but you have to learn to deal with it and live with it
and protect yourself. And a lot of our colleagues, it's very, very common for people to be online, release something, get so much abuse that they then go offline. Like, we wanted to, you know, I was looking for somebody online the other day, and then I messaged him being like, oh, you're not on social media. And then she was like, oh, no, I came off it after I did like a little bit on something and then got so much abuse that I came off it just to protect myself, my mental health and all the rest of it. So it is like a strange part of being a woman in comedy now that comes part and parcel. There is a bit of not fear about the material, but more the response.
I think you should start that phone line. I would ring it just to listen in. It would be a great radio station in and of itself.
Yeah, wouldn't it? Yeah, it'd have to go out late night.
Well, you could ring up and have a good scream.
Yeah, so well, that was going to say. I think, you know, it's future sketches, rage rooms, screams. That I hope we've given you some material.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, Lazy Susan is the name to collectively describe Freya Parker and Celestrin. Thank you so much. I adore this message from Kate. Just wanted to end with this. He says, I'm a 60-plus lady, runs her own business, and as well as being a farmer's wife, stress goes with the territory. My method of dealing with this has been to calmly pick up a metal bucket, take myself to a place away from everyone else, kick the bucket around the yard while screaming. I then pick up the bucket, I calmly return to the situation, and it's certainly better than breaking bottles of milk, which need cleaning, a lot of cleaning afterwards. Kate, thank you so much for that message. Absolutely adore it. Great mental images. The baking tray against the wall, the bucket round the yard. You're brilliant. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.